Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I'm a former middle school teacher, current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. And so I share ideas and strategies. I talk about protocols that worked for me, but I also share those stories of the big epic fails that I've made along the way. Because I'm still learning, and that's part of why I interview experts, which you probably noticed I've had a couple interviews with different experts lately, because I genuinely believe that teachers play a profound role in helping students reach their creative potential. And that creativity is vital for lifelong learning, but it's also one of those things that students will need in an unpredictable future. Right now I'm working on this book called The Depth Advantage. It's all about deeper learning in an age of distraction. It's about deeper engagement, but also deeper thinking and problem solving, deeper collaboration and connection with others. It's about this idea of deeper resilience and continuing to work when things get hard and when you're navigating that unpredictable maze and you hit a barrier, what do? It's about the idea of self-direction and deeper drive. And so I'm really excited about this book, and I often focus on what does it mean to prepare students for the future, but the core idea is also this, that one of the best ways to prepare students for the future is by empowering them in the present. And yes, that involves things like PBL, which we're gonna talk about today, but it also involves using so-called traditional strategies. Just because something is traditional doesn't mean it's bad. Now, before we get started, I just want to say one last piece. If you don't follow my blog, go check out spencereducation.com. And if you go to any of the blog posts at the very bottom, you'll see a space to sign up for the newsletter. Just sign up to the newsletter and you'll get my podcasts and my articles sent to you automatically in your inbox. Also, all kinds of different free resources that I create that are exclusive to just email subscribers. So go check that out if you haven't done so yet. Now, without further ado, let's jump right into today's topic, which is again all about 10 traditional teaching practices that actually belong in a PBL unit. So why do some students hate projects? We're gonna start there, and I'm gonna actually begin with a story. It's about 15 minutes before our mock trial practice, and a student walks up to me, and says, "Coach Spencer, what do you usually talk about when you go to conferences and speak?" I usually give a keynote about AI, or he cuts me off and says, "I don't really understand the terms. I've heard of generative AI. How is that different from non-generative AI?" And so we start talking about all kinds of different ideas. I talk about biases and hallucinations. I walk him through all these different ideas related to AI. And then I continue. I also give keynotes about student voice and choice and project-based learning. His face drops. "Is something wrong?" I ask. "Sorry, I just, I hate project-based learning," he answers. "Do you mind me asking why?" I ask. "It's always so big and overwhelming, and there's never enough class time, so I have to do almost everything at home. Plus, I end up being the only one in the group that does the work, and it feels, well, it feels meaningless. It's like busy work." "How so?" I ask. "Well, I think we're supposed to be learning the subject, but I never see the connection between the science concepts that we do and the project that we're doing. Plus, I'm not that artistic, and I feel like there's always this finished product, and I'm embarrassed to share what I've created. It's just a lot of time and stress, and honestly, not a lot of learning." "But you like mock trial, right?" I ask. "Absolutely, it's my favorite class," he answers. "Well, that's project-based learning," I point out. "But it's not really. We have deadlines and due dates. Each member is held accountable. Every one of us has a role with clear expectations. Plus, our teacher actually teaches us stuff. He does this short, like, mini lectures, and we practice the skill afterwards, and there's no product, right? It's just a performance." At this point, I share with him the key elements of project-based learning, and it's the sole idea of like, you know, a challenging problem or question, sustained inquiry, authenticity, student voice and choice, all of those things that we talk about, public product. If you follow this, you know, podcast for a while, you'll know, you know, these are the components, critique and revision, student reflection, all those seven pieces of PBL. And that's how, in general, PBL works, defines it. Different other PBL approaches have defined it differently. In fact, when you get into the research on PBL, you find that problem-based, project-based, and inquiry-based all have such huge overlap. But the core idea is it's authentic learning that's learning through the project in a way that incorporates critique and revision and reflection, and there's this inquiry, and it's really built on student ownership. So if we think about this, we want to have authentic PBL. That's the goal. And early on in my PBL journey, I actually didn't do authentic PBL. I created these highly structured projects that lacked any student agency. And, if a student said, I'm confused or I don't know what to do, I provided these hyper detailed instructions telling them exactly what to do. And then what began to happen is I was falling into what Chris Lehman describes as recipe-based learning. I remember listening to an interview with him, and he said, you know, if you assign a project and get back 30 of the exact same thing, that's not a project, that's a recipe. And I really respected the way he was doing PBL at the Science Leadership Academy in Philadelphia. And so I was like, well, let's think about this for a moment. Maybe I need to abandon some of the structure. But along the way, I made this mistake of going full scale to the opposite direction and scrapping all things traditional. And so I ended up, you know, doing this free-flowing, way too open-ended PBL. I did no direct instruction. I didn't have enough scaffolds, all these different components. And when I look back on that, I realize I assumed that traditional was automatically less authentic. And I don't think that's true. So I want to share 10 traditional teaching practices that still belong in a PBL unit. So number one is learning targets and agendas. For decades, researchers have pointed out that students will rarely transfer knowledge from PBL into new domains unless the teacher explicitly explains to them what's going on. So in Teaching for Transfer, for example, David Perkins and Gabrielle Salome differentiate between low road, which is automatic, and high road, which is deliberate and abstract transfer. And they argue that teachers need to clarify where the transfer is happening and engage students in guided reflection. Similarly, in How People Learn, the authors point out that transfer is highly context specific. So students need to know this. It doesn't just happen along the way. So what does that mean? It means that we have to tell them the learning targets and explain to them the transfer that is happening. If a key goal of PBL is for students to learn through the project, we need to ensure that students know what they are learning. And so that means we need to give them learning targets. We might have essential questions and guiding questions, but we need to explain to them the learning targets that they'll learn. Similarly, we need to give them an agenda. We need to give them a blueprint of where they're going. We need to let them know, hey, this is what we're working on in this project right now. And what that does is that reduces what's called the extraneous cognitive load. So the thinking involved in a project that has nothing to do with the learning is the extraneous cognitive load. And you need some of this in PBL, but you don't want to have so much that they aren't actually learning, that they're so focused on, you know, how do I do X, Y, Z, that they're failing to learn through the project. So learning targets and agendas are critical. The second thing seems a little bit surprising, but it's quizzes. And so what quizzes do is not so much quizzing for the purpose of grading, right? It's not a pop quiz. It's not a quiz at the end of the unit. What we're talking about here is short 2 to 5 question multiple choice quizzes. Some could be open-ended as well. And what we're doing is we're actually quizzing for the purpose of moving information from working memory to long-term memory. So if they're working on a project, we want to ensure that the project is actually leading to learning. So we're going to add some working memory and long-term memory encoding and retrieval. And this will also even add a little bit of rehearsal through this process of just quizzing. So again, it's not that the quiz just assesses did the student get it or not. It's actually that by doing a quiz, students are participating in this rehearsal process that guarantees that the learning becomes more sticky. Now, what I love about PBL is it gives an application for the learning. So the learning actually sticks and endures for a longer period of time. That's one of the things that you notice with PBL. And so what this quizzing process does is it sort of allows for more of this encoding and retrieval, and then that learning and the encoding and retrieval will last for a longer period of time because of the project. So you can sort of think about quiz as this short-term, you know, getting it into your memory. And then the PBL is that long-term sustainable stickiness of making sure that the learning endures. And really, what's happening at the student level is, on another level, students are figuring out, what do I know, what do I not know, and what do I need to do next? And so it's making them a little bit more aware of the knowledge that they might lack during a project. Number three is direct instruction and explicit modeling. I've talked about this a lot before on this podcast. There was a whole episode all about when and where we should implement direct instruction into project-based learning, but it's the notion that sometimes students lack the skills and they just need to see it modeled for them. So it might be writing and you're gonna show them how to use facts to defend an opinion. It might be that they're learning a scientific concept, so not necessarily a skill, but a concept, and you're gonna give them a demonstration, or they're gonna do a short lab that helps them understand a scientific concept. Maybe you're gonna do a concept attainment lesson and some lecture and explanation of, you know, certain elements of the Cold War as they work on a Cold War project, or Civil War as they talk about the Civil War and do a Civil War museum. So the point is, whether they're learning a skill or understanding a concept, we need to embed this direct instruction and at times even explicitly model with guided practice how to do a particular thing. And I remember when we were doing our documentary projects, I was a little frustrated that students didn't know how to just edit a video on iMovie. So I had to show them how to edit video on iMovie, and suddenly I'm doing direct instruction and guided practice, and I'm feeling like, oh, this is less authentic. And then I realized that's what we do all the time, right? If I'm working on a home improvement project, I'm gonna take the time to learn a particular skill and practice it by watching a YouTube video. It's no different. So we're gonna add some and infuse some direct instruction and explicit modeling within PBL. And again, that doesn't mean that you were abandoning our projects. We're just allowing them to work on what they need to work on, which leads to number four, skill practice. Sometimes you just need to have students do a handout. You need to have them work through three or four math problems. I remember we were doing our tiny house projects and they're applying the concepts of volume and surface area and proportional reasoning. And we would begin every project at the beginning of the day with 2 to 3 word problems, and they would just work through the word problems that connected to what they were going to do in this tiny house project. And it really built this bridge for them where they had the background knowledge to be able to figure out things like the surface area, the volume, the proportions within their tiny house. So again, skill practice is an important piece to add and include. Number five is cooperative learning structures. If you don't want to have the situation where one kid is doing all of the project for the group, we can certainly do things like having group roles, having group contracts, having some accountability built into it. But also using Kagan structures goes a long way here. And the notion is you're building interdependence into it. So this could be think pair shares, time pair shares, round robin, rally robin, jigsaw, a pairs check piece that they do, carousel activity, stand up, hand up, pair up, whatever those may be. And those are all great opportunities for students to work interdependently while they're still owning the process of doing a project. So that adds some structure to it. It adds some soft accountability to it. It makes the process more visible. And I've just found that that really helps with the group participation issue that sometimes happens in PBL. Number six is note-taking. I just want to point out, anyone that I've ever known that does actual projects has times where they have to take notes. And so that's part of it. It's an authentic thing. Project people take notes. But beyond that, there's this other thing of permanent knowledge or knowledge transfer. And in mock trial, the teacher and head coach, Drew, who leads it, often says, ink it to think it. And I love it. Same concept is here. So making sure that we have students take notes, it can be sketch notes, Cornell notes, it could be Venn diagrams that they fill out. It could be that when they're doing research, they're taking notes with a spreadsheet, whatever it may be. And the process of note-taking helps them, yes, with, you know, determining where they are. They can go back to their notes later. It improves the quality of their project. But also what's happening is that process of note-taking is itself a retrieval and encoding process. So it's allowing them to encode what they're learning and then retrieve it later through practice. Number seven, visible thinking strategies. Similar to the concept of cooperative learning, visible thinking strategies adds structure to what you're doing, but it also makes projects more concrete. And so I'm not gonna go into all the different examples, but in the book, Making Thinking Visible, there's so many different protocols that you can use and just integrate those into your projects. I have a friend who is a software engineer and I recommended the book Making Thinking Visible to him when he was leading a training. And since then, his whole team is using these visible thinking protocols from that book. And you're talking about adults who are in general a little skeptical. They kind of have strong opinions, as a lot of software engineers do and a lot of coders. And they have just found that these strategies really, really work. Number eight, scaffolds and supports. Look, you need to have ELL supports, those sentence stems, front-loaded vocabulary, mini lessons, grammatical help, whatever it may be. And if you go to the blog post that corresponds to this podcast, I have more details about specific structures and strategies. Similarly, we can do things like using AI to break down tasks for students with executive function issues, pulling small groups during a PBL unit and making it more accessible that way. So all of these are ways that we can do number eight, which is providing scaffolds and supports. And I think, again, that's really important for students, that they have access to the learning supports that they need. Number nine, I've alluded to this already a bit, but look, deadlines and due dates. Projects in life have due dates. They have deadlines. There's nothing wrong with taking a big project and breaking it down into phases and stages with due dates, taking big tasks and breaking them down into subtasks. Now, we can add more student ownership to it by incorporating elements of project management, which I think works really well. But one of the things that happens when we break projects into deadline to phases with deadlines and due dates is it's reducing that extraneous cognitive load that I mentioned before, so they can focus on the learning at hand. But also it mimics what they're gonna experience in doing projects in life. They are going to have deadlines. In life, when you do a project, you at least have a goal of when you wanna accomplish it. Sometimes it's a hard deadline, sometimes it's a soft deadline, but there's a deadline and that's gonna be a part of the process. Number 10, the final one, is formative assessments. And so this is basically the notion of assessing as we go, incorporating checklists, peer feedback processes, self-reflections, but also, you know, just short checking for understanding moments, pulling students with for one-on-one or small group conferences. Make sure that you are assessing them each day as you would in any other lesson that you teach. In the end, the bottom line is this: project-based learning works because it's authentic, not because it's new, not because it's innovative, not because it's progressive. It shouldn't surprise us then that certain traditional strategies and approaches work really well, and they are effective in PBL. Ultimately, our goal is to embrace both the tried and true and the never tried, and to discover our next practices while using our best practices. So yes, there's a time and a place to use these traditional practices within project-based learning. Hey, thank you so much for listening to this podcast. Would you do me a favor? If you enjoy it, would you leave a review on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify, Amazon, wherever it is that you get your podcast? Again, thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day and go out and make something awesome.